This is NPR News. I'm Mike Mulcahy. A report released by the Department of Homeland Security last week says Russian operatives launched a cyber attack against American and European nuclear power plants and water and electric systems. The Trump administration says the hackers never went so far as to sabotage or shut down the computer systems that guide the operations of the plants and the power grid, but apparently they could have if they wanted to. It doesn't take much to imagine the chaos that would ensue if the power went out across a wide part of the country for any length of time. And when you stop to think for a minute about our power grid, hackers are just one problem. The biggest cause of power outages is falling trees and branches that take down wires. Even cold and hungry squirrels have been known to take out the power. It's the latest sign that our power systems are 20th century technology that can barely keep up with our 21st century demand. And guess what? Upgrades are not going to be cheap or easy. We're going to talk about it this hour. I'm joined by two guests. John McWilliams is a fellow at the Center on Global Energy Policy at Columbia University and a former official in the Federal Department of Energy. And Gretchen Bakke is the author of the 2016 book, The Grid, The Fraying Wires Between Americans and Our Energy Future. You can get your question in, too. Just give us a call, 651-227-6000. 651-227-6000. Are you willing to pay higher utility bills to keep the power grid secure? That's the question. 651-227-6000. John McWilliams, Gretchen Bakke, thanks for being here.
Pleasure to be here.
Thank you.
I suppose we should start by defining our terms a bit. When we talk about the power grid or the electrical grid, what exactly is it that we're talking about? John McWilliams, let me start with you.
Well, and actually, as Gretchen describes in her really good book that I actually use in my course that I teach at Columbia, the grid, the power grid, is an interconnected series of transmission lines which connect really a complex system of different types of power generation, whether it's coal-fired plants, gas, nuclear, renewable, et cetera. It's actually a regionalized plant, which Gretchen can obviously speak to in detail.
Well, Gretchen, I wanted to ask you about that because I wonder if the term grid, in your head, you think of as sort of a nationwide system, but it was really built more in sort of a piecemeal fashion, wasn't it?
Yeah, and I think even the pieces of the grid that are deeply interconnected with each other, they're still local. So you can talk about the Western grid, for example, in the United States, but you still have a very different thing happening in, you know, Southern California than you have in the Pacific Northwest. So there's sort of all of these layers of localness and then all of these layers of technologies and then all of these layers of different sort of organizational patterns and ways of making money off of the grid that makes it not just a confusing, complicated technological structure, but also a confusing, complicated social and economic structure. So there's many, every time we talk about changing the grid, you can just sort of see the beginnings of one of those sort of giant domino, you know, mosaics where you just tip the first domino and everything goes every which way. And it's very hard to think about what will actually be the outcome of any action that we take on the system as a whole.
And when you think about it, it's interesting. I mean, it must have built up over the early part of the last century around population centers, right? Once electricity came in and people wanted it, they had to build up this grid to supply it, right?
Yeah, and actually it wasn't so much people wanting it in the beginning. It was where could you sell it and make a profit? Mm. And that was, in fact, in densely populated urban areas initially. So you have a lot of electricity sort of activity in New York City and in Chicago, and also in smaller municipalities like Muncie. And then it was only during the Great Depression that these little pockets of kind of dense electrical infrastructure were legislated into the rural areas because you couldn't actually make a profit by running lines into, you know, to farms, for example. So the government subsidized that piece of the process. And that's why we often have rural cooperatives who are in charge of electrical systems in rural areas. And then you have bigger for-profit utilities like Xcel in charge of the whole electrical system in the urban areas. Even though they're all connected, when you turn on a power plant, the electricity is moving around through all of those lines, regardless of who is actually governing that particular piece of the system.
And John McWilliams, when I use electricity, is that mostly generated close to me, or does the grid allow the electricity to be generated far away from me and come to me when I need it?
It's actually a little bit of both, and as Gretchen was just describing it, you know, although the grid has grown organically over the years and is fairly old at this point, or at least portions of it are, and it needs to become much more intelligent, which we can talk about, it is a really complex process to move electrons around the country. And particularly when one thinks about all the different interconnected power sources that I was referring to earlier, particularly renewable sources, all those things are connected and controlled often remotely. And that's why, as we'll talk about, all those things are vulnerable to cyber attacks.
Well, that was actually my next question.
Sorry.
Why is it so vulnerable to hacking?
Well, as I said, when you think of the grid, and it is actually more than just the wires. It's this whole complex systems. And so when you think of all the power generation types of facilities that are inputting into that grid, and then all of the controls which are automated required to move the electrons around these regions and ultimately around the country, essentially anything that has access to the internet and even some things that don't are vulnerable to cyber intrusion. At the beginning of the show, you mentioned this new report that came out. It was from the Department of Homeland Security and the FBI just last week, and it was from something called the U.S. Computer Energy Readiness Team, and it was entitled Russian Government Cyber Activity Targeting Energy and Other Critical Infrastructure. The reason that's so significant, this obviously builds upon years of work, and we were obviously involved in this at the Department of Energy when I was there. But it specifically refers to Russian government cyber actors and talking about how they are engaged in a multi-stage intrusion campaign to target and to potentially attack the energy sector, specifically industrial control systems. And those are these systems that I was referring to that are so important in managing and operating the grid.
And I want to talk about that. I just tell the listeners, that's John McWilliams. He's a fellow at the Center on Global Energy Policy at Columbia University. I'm also joined by Gretchen Bakke. She's the author of a book called The Grid, The Fraying Wires Between Americans and Our Energy Future. And great people who know a lot about this subject. If you have a question, give us a call, 651-227-6000. 651-227-6000. And let me just ask both of you maybe, what's the worst case scenario in this hacking incident? What could have happened? John, let me start with you again, then we'll go to Gretchen.
Sure. When you think of cyber attacks, broadly speaking, there's sort of two stages, types of attacks. There are stage one attacks, which are targeted reconnaissance, potentially what we refer to as preparing the battle space. Then there are stage two attacks where cyber is being used to actually disrupt or destroy systems. The vast bulk of the things we've seen over the last couple of years in the U.S. Energy sector have been these target one, the stage one type attacks. But what's notable in this report is that the report talks how the Russian government was, in fact, targeting industrial control systems. So the worst that can happen is that they or others could come in and disable, either temporarily or actually permanently, large portions of the generation capability, which then feeds into the grid. There's your listeners could go on YouTube and look up Idaho National Labs Project Aurora, and you can see an experiment that was conducted at the Idaho National Lab, which is owned by the Department of Energy, where in less than a minute, a cyber attack caused a diesel generator, a power generator, to destroy itself. So that's the type of damage one can imagine, you know, much greater types of damage.
And Gretchen Bakke, it's not just hacking that can pose this kind of a threat to the system, right?
Well, I think that what's interesting about the sort of about the hacking as a problem is that it's a result of the ways in which we've been trying to make the system work better with renewables. So as we bring more and more variable sorts of generation online, which means wind power, for example, that is producing more electricity when the wind is blowing more strongly and none when the wind isn't blowing at all, or solar, which works in essentially the same way with the sun, these systems actually need more computerization. We talk about the smart grid, but that's essentially what it means, in order to interface well with the existing grid. And as much as we want all of these renewables to come in, the complexity of integrating them and the computerization that's necessary to integrate them safely into the system then also opens doors to hacking attempts. And there's been a lot of conversation over the time that I've been working on sort of researching the grid on what the vulnerabilities are. And it's just sort of seeing them go from physical attacks just sort of slowly sliding year by year by year until the present, at which cyber attacks or hacking is actually something that needs to be guarded against in a much more sort of aggressive way, I think. Mm-hmm. And I feel like people within the industry actually know that. It's just a very difficult task.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's take a call. Al is on the line from Eden Prairie.
Hello there. This great conversation this morning. I've got a fairly nice size solar array on top of my house, which covers, depending on the time of year, either all or, you know, a decent percentage, except in the dead of winter when there's snow. So for me, pretty much, for the most part, the grid is more of a battery backup than anything else. But my question is, well, two quick ones. Number one, is it possible that there's a way that we can somehow do a little more local, really local, not just up in Monticello and down south in the other two big plants, but more locally, smaller, controlled, and segmented, locally generated electricity, so we don't, we can, if something big happens on the grid, we can, basically cut the line, and we'll be okay in our little area. And the second quick thing is, when you talk about how kind of ironic bringing in renewables has made us less secure, kind of weird, it reminds me of what just happened with the DMV. They just got done doing, which is a fairly, not a humongous department in not a really big state. We're having nightmares with our software upgrades just to do a DMV upgrade. That's nowhere near as critical as our power grid. So that worries me a little bit. I wonder if you guys can talk about both of those things.
Okay, very good questions. Gretchen, let's start with you.
I think that the question that you ask about sort of your solar panels and also how they interact with the grid is kind of the question on everybody's, sort of the tip of everybody's tongue right now. One of the reasons that the grid is so vulnerable is because it's so interconnected. So to these kinds of attacks, the interconnectedness makes it very strong and very robust in other ways. But the question then becomes, can we island, which is the technical term for it, little pieces of the grid, so that if there is a successful attack that actually just sort of brings to ground a larger power plant, can smaller communities or even individual homes be used as warming houses or even secure spaces for to keep people warm and fed and in touch with each other. And there are a lot of these questions came up after Superstorm Sandy. Mm-hmm. Right now, and maybe John can actually add to this or correct me if I'm wrong, in most places in the U.S., it's not possible to run your solar system for your house and not at, when the power is down on the larger grid. So you are essentially with your solar array not producing power for your home, but you're producing power for the grid. So everybody that has solar is functioning like this power plant kind of shattered over a over space and privatized. And so questions then become, what is the software that allows that sort of radical cultural change to happen, which might actually then in fact make us more secure, or the word is usually used is resilient, as a nation to the kinds of attacks that actually target our interconnectedness or the interconnectedness of the existing system.
John McWilliams.
Yeah, well, that's exactly right. And, you know, what Gretchen's talking about here is that there are really two sides to this. Distributed generation microgrids, the kinds of facilities that you're that Al is talking about, where we have individual solar arrays, et cetera. The hope is that in some ways moving to more distributed generation provides resilience. And I was on the Hurricane Sandy task force after the hurricane. And there were situations there, such as universities, Princeton, for example, that survived pretty well because they had their own microgrid. On the other hand, as Gretchen also mentioned, in practice, almost all of these, and I don't know if this is true with Al, with your particular solar array, but most of it is connected in one way or the other back to the utility or through the internet. What we've what's happened is that utilities in the country are rapidly going through a transformation where they're becoming more customer-centric, or they're going to need to, because they're exchanging information and electricity back and forth between the customer through smart meters. But all of these smart meters are connected in one way or another to the internet, and that becomes an attack vector or platform for cyber attacks. So it is ironic that as we improve and make our grid more intelligent, which it needs to be because of the introduction of renewable intermittent power sources and other things, we are introducing new vulnerabilities as we go.
We're talking about the power grid this hour. The Trump administration reported that it was hacked by the Russians. They reported that last week. As you can tell, it's a complex topic. We'll continue in just a minute, and we'll take more of your calls as well. But first, let's check in with Mike Moen and get a news update. Hi, Mike.
Hello, Mike. Authorities are confident that the 23-year-old man who blew himself up as police closed in was behind this month's Austin bombings, but they still don't know why he did it. Police say Mark Anthony Condit left behind a 25-minute cell phone video that details the differences in the bombs he built, but they're still trying to determine why exactly he planted them and whether he picked his targets at random. The bombs killed two people and injured four others. A joint investigation by the Associated Press and Houston Chronicle reveals that the extent of Hurricane Harvey's toxic assault on the environment was more widespread than authorities publicly reported after the storm flooded the nation's fourth largest city. Reporters cataloged more than 100 Harvey-related toxic releases on land and water and air. Most were never publicized. Two experts say a video of a deadly crash involving a self-driving Uber vehicle shows the SUV's laser and radar sensors should have spotted a pedestrian. They also say the car's computer should have braked and steered to avoid the crash. Authorities investigating the incident in a Phoenix suburb released video Wednesday of the Uber SUV hitting the woman as she walked from a darkened area onto a street. And stocks are falling sharply at this hour, and bond prices are climbing as investors fear that trade tensions will spike between the U.S. and China. The Trump administration is expected to announce hefty trade sanctions on China later today, while the government in Beijing says it will defend itself. Right now in the Twin Cities, cloudy skies, 38 degrees. More news ahead on Minnesota Public Radio News. It's 11:39.
On the next NPR News Presents, a live broadcast of the Westminster Town Hall Forum featuring journalist Susie Hansen, author of Notes on a Foreign Country and American Abroad in a Post-American World. You can hear her at noon and 9 p.m. on NPR News.
Programming is supported by Housing First, housing professionals across Minnesota that are dedicated to building safe, durable, and affordable homes. More about housing affordability for Minnesota at housingfirstnetwork.org, sponsored by the Housing First Network. Programming supported by Lyman Doran, offering executive search and leadership consulting for privately held companies and nonprofit organizations. Online at lymandoran.com. Lyman Doran, building the right leadership for what's next.
And it's Member Appreciation Week at NPR News. Thank you to all of the members who keep this essential news and information on the air each day, including Kelly in Winnebago, Gary in Hayfield, and Jackie in Minneapolis. Thank you for being part of the incredible community that powers NPR News. You can find out more about Member Appreciation Week at npr.org/thanks. And now we will continue with our discussion about the electrical grid, the threats it's under, and the future of the grid. I'm joined by two guests. Gretchen Bakke is the author of a book called The Grid, The Fraying Wires Between Americans and Our Energy Future. And John McWilliams is a fellow at the Center on Global Energy Policy at Columbia University and a former official in the Federal Department of Energy. You can join us with your call if you have a question. 651-227-6000 is the number to call. 651-227-6000. And let's go right back to the phones. Garrett is on the line in Minneapolis, and I've been keeping him waiting for a while. Garrett, go ahead.
Yeah, thank you. Just a real quick question here. So I guess generally, if everything in our homes and businesses demands basically have decreased in consumption, figure like light bulbs, HVAC, tube TVs, converted to LEDs, you know, everything like that, why do we still kind of hear about that grid strain and kind of how have the costs stabilized or stayed the same despite the fact that we're using, and I'm just going to guess, like maybe even potentially up to like a third of what we used to? I guess, does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. So we've gotten more energy efficient is the argument. Why do we have to keep expanding the grid? Who wants to try that one? John McWilliams, how about you?
Sure. Well, you do point out an important point, Garrett, which is that we've seen a great deal of energy efficiency, particularly over the last few years, and particularly in the developed world, developed countries such as the United States and Europe, and that trend is likely to continue. A lot of what's causing the strain are the types of things that Gretchen was talking about a few minutes ago, that as we have new types of power generation on the one hand, so we have solar and wind, which are intermittent sources. The sun doesn't always shine, the wind doesn't always blow. And so managing these inflows and then drops of power feeding into the grid is very complex. At the same time, we're starting to move into a world where we're going to see very rapidly here the introduction of electric vehicles, and those create a two-way flow between the car that's sitting in your garage, which is at sometimes being powered or fed by the grid, but also selling power back into the grid and functioning eventually as millions of distributed storage sites. As you do this, and then at the same time, as the home becomes more complex, and as we have all these appliances that are smart appliances in our house, so your laundry may be being done at 2 o'clock in the morning when power is cheaper, these two-way flows back and forth, this relationship that you're going to have with the utility and ultimately with the grid is much more complex. And therefore, the demands on the grid, which is a fairly old and somewhat dumb, if you will, infrastructure, are going to have to increase, and the grid's going to have to become much more intelligent. And then, unfortunately, that does create some additional vulnerabilities.
And Gretchen Bakke, you mentioned this notion of the smart grid. What does that look like, and how far away are we from a smart grid?
Can I say something about to the caller?
Oh,
first
absolutely, before? Sure. Yeah.
Okay. I think one of the things that we've left out of the conversation is that, but which I think many people don't know, is that the amount of electricity coming into the electrical grid needs to be balanced by about the minute to the amount of electricity that is going out of the electrical grid or is being used. And that means that when you turn on a light in your house, somewhere there's a source of generation that is ramping up a little bit in order to provide the electricity to that light. And the way that it always was historically was that all of the randomness was on how much we used. But there was a kind of steadiness to how much was produced. It could be adjusted up and down, but it wasn't dependent on something like the wind, which is always changing how fast it's blowing. And now we have randomness on both sides. And a lot of what the computerization is trying to do, and this then gets us to the smart grid, is to be able to allow our machines to actually then talk to the electric grid and say, hey, is there any power right now? So instead of me doing my dishes when I feel like it, I press a button on my dishwasher that says, you now have permission, dishwasher of mine, to turn on when there's electricity available. So then if it becomes very windy at 2 o'clock in the morning, my dishwasher understands, because it's talking to the grid, that it can now wash the dishes because there's plenty of electricity available to it. So instead of always controlling how much electricity we produce, now with the influx of renewables, we need to control in some way when we're using electricity. And you might notice that your dishwasher doesn't do this yet. Right. So when we talk about the smart grid, or we talk about computerization of the home, or the complexity of what's going to happen to the machines in the home, a lot of what that conversation means is simply that machines will start talking to machines and adjust themselves in order to create a balance between how much electricity is going into the system and how much is being demanded of the system at the same instant. Electricity is very, very, very fast. Faster than we can think it, faster than we can call somebody up and say, hey, we need you to turn a power plant up or turn a power plant down. And the smartness or the computerization allows for machines to talk to each other as fast as they can, which is a lot faster than we can.
So who is responsible for making the grid smarter? Is it the utility companies? Is it the ratepayers like me, you and me? Is it both?
Yeah, I mean, we're all in it. That's one of the great things about the way that the grid is transforming in the U.S. is that it's piecemeal, it's quite rapid, and it's very uneven, and it has made it sort of fun, if not always entirely stable, to let that process go. So yes, it's the utility company, absolutely. It's also the first caller who has solar panels on his roof. It's also the regulators. It's also the there was an earlier story about Xcel wanting to keep its nuclear power plants online. It's also this push for certain kinds of very, very stable electricity. It's inventors. You know, the number of letters that I get from people who've invented a thing that, you know, that can do a thing. And I'm sure that some of them have, in fact, have done that. So it's quite exciting. But then again, as John pointed out, there's always this sort of flip side to that, which is that with every action, there's vulnerabilities being introduced into the system.
And John McWilliams, how much is it going to cost to smarten up the grid?
Well, depending on how far one goes, the process of sort of smartening up the grid is going to take years, and it will evolve, and it will undoubtedly be in the hundreds of billions, if not larger amounts of money. But one thing to also recognize is that most energy infrastructure in the United States is privately owned. And therefore, and we can talk about this if you wish in terms of what the government's doing to try to work with industry on the cyber side, but fundamentally it comes down to utilities being able to make capital investments to improve their systems and their interactions with the grid, and largely that requires them being able to put those expenditures into what's referred to as the rate base. so they can receive a return on that. And so what's important here is working also with the public utility commissions in each state to help utility commissions understand some of these issues, the need to make the grid more intelligent, both from providing these additional services, but also to protect against these vulnerabilities so that we can build out out the grid.
Let's hear from another caller. Mike, another Mike is on the line in Minneapolis. Mike, go ahead.
Hi there. I worked for the telephone companies in the 80s and 90s, and this conversation reminds me of the conversations that were going on in the telecommunications industry back then. People in the phone companies were worried about what would happen if somebody were able to attach a dial-up modem to the telephone network. What is the internet going to do as it grows, and will it subsume the telephone network? And, you know, as we can see, the internet brought us great advantages and exposed us to some risks that we need to learn and are learning to manage. And the risks of not learning to manage the distributed energy resources are tremendous, too. They include having to go to war and having to manage terrible pollution. So, you know, progress marches on, and we just have to do it smartly is what I think.
Okay, let's react. Go ahead, John.
Yeah, I just wanted to say that Mike is touching upon a very important point, which is what we're seeing is a convergence of power, transportation, and communications. So exactly the point that you started with, Mike, here, as we're seeing this convergence between these three sectors, they're all increasing the demands on the electricity grid to be more intelligent, but they're also increasing vulnerabilities because, for example, we've been hearing a lot about electric vehicles. There's a report today, which was mentioned in your earlier report about the first autonomous vehicle accident. But imagine when 50% or more of vehicles are electric vehicles and they're being powered in charging stations, either in your garage or out in the street. All of those things are vulnerable to cyber attack. In fact, the cars that you drive today are vulnerable to cyber attack. So it becomes this ecosystem that's interdependent that we have to think about as we move forward.
Gretchen, any reaction to the caller? I don't want to step on you. I should just tell the listeners we're not actually in the same room. If you want to talk about technology, we're talking across the country, across the world here. Go ahead, Gretchen. Sorry.
I think that there have been many people have brought up this transition in the telecommunications as as a model for how grid transformation could happen. And when I mean grid transformation, I'm talking about the infrastructure, but also the companies that take care of, manage, and own that infrastructure. And the desire was always to do the transition sort of like telecommunications did it, but with fewer fatalities. And I don't mean people, but actual companies. Can it be managed in a way that keeps more companies in business? And I'm not sure that that's happened. But I think that the great transformation, which John was already pointing to, was this movement from thinking of ratepayers as just a source of income, essentially, to ratepayers as a customer, and that what's being provided then is a service, not a thing. And what are the services then that the grid can provide to customers? And so that transformation is definitely following telecommunications. The thing that's a little bit different is that you can't yet make the grid in any substantive kind of way, which is more than 8 inches, let's say, wireless. And so there's a big piece of what happened to telecommunications that can't happen when you're talking about electrical infrastructure. And I feel like there's a big fantasy out there of like, let's make it all 100% renewable because that's the right thing to do. And somehow we can get rid of all of the wires simultaneously. And the actual pragmatics of both of those projects of dewiring the grid, which is certainly happening in some places where, apropos of the first caller, electricity starts to be made more robust at the local level as opposed to further away in bigger plants. You see this especially in Australia. You don't see it as much in the US. But there are things happening that make us have fewer wires. But that also makes, again, it makes the grid weaker as a system that then we need to invent our way into figuring out how to have a stable source of electricity for everybody, which is affordable. And I think that we constantly cycle back around to this idea that electricity, like drinkable water, is something that all Americans should have access to. And it's hard to do. And with the phone system, we do mostly all still have access, but in a way, like if you don't have a phone, you know, I guess maybe you're cut out completely from the modern life. Maybe, maybe that's actually true now. But if you don't have electricity, it's almost unthinkable that you would have a home or a neighborhood or a part of the country that has less good, less stable, or just no electricity at all. And that's kind of what we're up against with this transition. We have to do it well.
Okay. I want to take another Mike, from Midland, South Dakota on line one. Mike, go ahead.
Good morning, and thanks for taking my call. My comments are, I'm an electrician, a retired electrician, and so I'm not claiming to be an expert on the distribution system. I work, I've been from the meter downstream on local use inside of facilities and how and residential. But I think that this is a great conversation to be having, and I hope that people will understand that this is if it's a national security problem, and there has to be a national answer to it. And there are things in place that are you know, up to the individual states, the public utilities commissions in the various states, and the different rules that they have from state to state is one of the issues regarding net metering. And I was wondering if they had anything to say on that. Net metering being the ability of a local producer of electricity to be able to sell it back to the utility, to the serving utility, and they have different rules from state to state.
Right, which has kind of made the rooftop solar tied into the grid possible, right? John McWilliams, does this need a national standard?
Yeah, Mike's pointing out an important point, which is in this country, electricity, power generation in general, is controlled in really at the federal level, state level, and local level. And in some ways, that can make it difficult to make investments in certain parts of the energy sector. In other ways, it provides a certain amount of resilience. When we look at this as a national security issue at the Department of Energy in Washington, really you're looking at there's no silver bullets here. And so this is a multi-layered, continual effort involving, first of all, partnering with the private sector, with the utilities. One of the things we spend a lot of time, and I know the department is continuing to do this, is to work with, for example, utility executives to help them understand the threats. At one point, we even took a number of CEOs from the utilities and arranged for them to get top secret clearances for a day so that we could explain some of the classified intelligence to help them understand the threats. But also, working with the states and with local government as well, and I mentioned already the public utility commissions. So it really is a multi-layered effort that's required because there is no single actor, if you will, that one can work with.
Well, you've given us so much to think about, and I'm sorry to say we're just plain out of time. Thanks so much for being with us, John McWilliams from Columbia University and Gretchen Bakke, author of the book The Grid, The Fraying Wires Between Americans and Our Energy Future.